the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont poet Laura Budovsky Vishnevsky, the author of Sanctuary, Vermont, and How to Prepare Bear. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming in the Missouri Review, Narrative, Image, Hunger Mountain Review, Ruminate Magazine, American Journal of Poetry, Saranac Review, Confrontation, and other journals. She's also the winner of the 2020 Janet B. McCabe Poetry Prize, the 2019 Poetry International Prize, and the 2014 Passenger Poetry Prize. Laura, who is 70, lives quietly in a small Vermont town. Selected as the winner of the 2020 Horizon Poetry Prize by Katie Ford, Sanctuary Vermont gives voice to present, past, and future residents of a richly imagined Vermont town. Laura Budovsky Vishnevsky joins the lineage of Edgar Lee Masters, Gwendolyn Brooks, and Louise Gluck in inhabiting and valorizing the extraordinary inner lives of everyday people. Sanctuary's townspeople endure hardships and loneliness, suffer injustice and racism, but still find moments of solace, beauty, and communion. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Laura. With this collection, it's so interesting, and there's clearly a story behind it. So I wondered if we could start with how the collection began for you, and a little bit about the town you're writing about, which I assume is not a real town, Sanctuary, Vermont, but what it's based on.
Okay. First of all, thank you so much for having me. This is great. So I live in a small town, and I was walking around town, and there's a fair amount of new commercial and residential development. And I thought, this is going to be gone soon. And so my first impulse was just to document this small town. And then I went to a little exhibit of local history of my town at my wonderful, wonderful local library. And I noticed that this history only included one section of the people who had actually lived there. It was only the people from kind of Anglican descent who lived in the hills.
Oh.
Where were the rest of the people? So those two things kind of took parallel roads. And as I started to research my town and other small towns in attempt to just document the small town before it's completely taken over with whatever it's going to be taken over with, all of these, I know it might sound woo, but just all of these like characters, people just showed up and they're like, excuse me, I'd like to say something about my experience. So obviously it was very researched, but that just kind of opened a portal for these voices that to some extent haven't really been given voice in history.
Yeah, wonderful. I don't usually start with structure, but your structure's interesting. You have two sections, basically, then and now. Mm-hmm. Then being poems that take place in the past up to a certain point, and now being from that point forward. And then on either side of then and now, you have a single poem. One seems to go back farther than we could really understand fully, and one goes into the future that we can't understand fully. So that was really interesting to me, and I'm not going to ask you to read the future one, but I wondered if you could talk about the structure that you decided on, and then maybe you could read about Main Street 450 million BCE.
Okay. I really struggled with the structure. You know, it's my first collection. I'm like, and I had all these complicated things where I was going to interweave this and put in theme and blah, blah, blah. And then finally, I just had one of those like, you know, Laura, just make it simple. And so it's chronological for the historical poems. And in terms of the organization of the poems that are more or less contemporaneous, that was, you know, just kind of that feel in terms of which poems seem to make sense to come after which. And, you know, some of the poems are kind of hard to, you know, upsetting, hard to read. So occasionally I'm like, you know, can you maybe give the reader a break here with something a little lighter? So because it's historical, it just, of course, made just common sense to start at the beginning and go through to the end.
I think that you are one of the authors who does a beautiful job of representing Vermont in a very real way. You know, Vermont is always very Hallmark Christmas card presentation. And there's a little of that in here because there's a little of that in life, you know. But the lives of these people in the 19th century were hard, right? Like you talk about the hard stuff. And So I thought you did a great job of that.
Thank you.
So maybe you can read about Main Street, 450 million BCE.
Okay. All right. About Main Street, 450 million BCE. Before there was this cataclysm doled itself out in slow drift, driven by restlessness, by wander love, in sluggish push, in shear of earth sheaths, mountains thrust up rough east, flatlands spread out sweet soiled west. Our Main Street runs the fault line like a scar, say some.
Thank you. That was great. And I really like the fact that Main Street runs the fault line because it really ties this, you know, 450 million BCE event to the town, which is important since the collection is about a town. What was your impulse to start right there?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot that came through in my research and hopefully in the book about these fault lines, social economic fault lines, and my own town. And I think other towns see these along socioeconomic lines. And as I was doing my research, I'm like, in my town, in fact, this particular geological event, the Taconic orogeny, when, you know, Vermont is hills and, you know, some flatlands, that Main Street does in fact like divide the hills from the flatlands in my town, and not only my town. And the hill people historically, because they had the water running down, owned the mills and had all sorts of socioeconomic advantage. And the flatlands were, you know, farmers, you know, with a much different and more hardscrabble life. And I was really pleased to have this poem start the book because in this state, I'm sure other states, but in this state, you can't separate the land, you can't separate the landscape, you can't separate the geology from the history and the culture. So that seemed to be a good place to start.
And why wasn't that part of then? That's another question I have. Not that it should have been. I liked it very much. I was just curious. You just decided.
Well, I guess just because there was, I think you answered that question. If you're going back 450 million years, that's a different concept of time, just like the future is. So yeah, it's then, but I don't know, 450 million is a different then for me than 1816, you know?
Exactly. Okay, great. Well, speaking of 1816, I was going to ask you to read Our Year Without Summer, 1816.
Sure. Our Year Without Summer, 1816. Every month there was a frost. Frozen birds fell rigid from the sky. Shorn sheep perished where they stood. The corn crop failed, as did the grain. Even Mrs. Moore, who heretofore had put on airs, bowed her head in thanks for hedgehog stew and nettles. In June, when Prudence Lexter froze while fetching wood, I took her 7 children in. Poor spindly dears. They died, all but the oldest girl, when the sickness came. It struck us like a drunkard's blow. Boys took up spades to help George Franklin dig the graves, but the stunned ground would not break. That smooth-skinned pastor up from Boston blamed it on our sins, on our youngsters stealing kisses in the birches down by Black Plum Lake. A God who wields his anger cold. I do not hold to that. I say we are a frail and faltering flock cast out into this wilderness of rocks and wind. The touch of skin to skin is all we've got. I'd rather praise the blood than curse the heart.
Thank you for reading that. It's hard, right? So it's hard. And did this really happened, right? I mean, I remember hearing of a year where it was cold all year. And So I'm curious how you can, well, I loved Mrs. Moore, who heretofore had put on airs. It's not a super formal collection, and I don't see a ton of rhyme in it, but that every once in a while, there's just wonderful stuff like that that jumps out. I wonder if you can talk about characters, naming characters, and how many of these stories are based on something you came across in your research, not a specific number, but, you know, generally.
Yeah. There aren't, the history is true. In 1816, there was, due to a volcano in Indonesia, it was very, very cold because there was so much ash. And in this year, a lot of people in Vermont just were like, that's it, I'm done with this. And they just left the state. As far as Mrs. Moore or Prudence Lexter, or George Franklin, they just showed up for the poems. there are a couple of poems, I'm trying to think, there are a couple of poems that were based on specific newspaper articles or, you know, specific stories that I came up in my research, but most of them were just, this is the time, this is what was going on, and these characters stepped forward for the poems.
And then there's this wonderful moment in the, I'm going to say narration of the poem, where there's suddenly a first-person narrator. And I love that because we don't have that in the first stanza. And it's not until the second line of the second stanza that I took her 7 children in. And that's a wonderful sort of surprise because all of a sudden there's a speaker who's experienced this cold winter and this horrible time. So I loved that. And then also I wanted to just mention that there's a lake in a sanctuary called Black Plum Lake. And there are a lot of references throughout the collection to plums and Black Plum Lake and also places named for plums. So I wondered if you can talk a little bit about how that runs through the collection as a sort of thread that ties things together and how also repeated themes and objects can act as signposts in a similar way.
Yeah. I think I took my cue from what goes on in towns, you know, that there are constellations around a place in terms of names. And I'm sure that you noticed, and you might mention the Tears and Fears Cafe. I think that's kind of an anchor, a theme that's an anchor, shows up a number of times. And there are certain places, or in this case, institutions that can be a little bit more mythical than just factual. So Black Plum Lake is a place that's there, and we see this all the time. History goes by, but such and such corners or such and such pond or such, you know, those places, they're there and history changes and they're still there. In terms of using those, that's a way to show the continuity. sometimes history doesn't come across to us as continuous. It comes to us as discrete because we look at this moment in history and that moment in history. And one of the things that I really was grateful for in doing my research was the sense of how history is so continuous, even when great big terrible things happen that seem to, you know, sever the line of history, it's still everything in history comes after the thing right before it. And I wanted to include that sense in the collection, if that makes any sense.
It does, absolutely. Yeah, it does. And it's funny, I'm just thinking to myself, I got a bunch of things striking me as you're talking. Like you mentioned the Tears and Fears Cafe, and I like, and I'm going to ask you or point this out later when we're talking about it more specifically, but there are a number of places in this collection where then and now show how history can repeat itself too, which is really kind of fun. And that happens in that cafe, for example. However, before we get to that, I'm sticking pretty much chronologically to the history of Sanctuary Vermont. And I'm wondering if you could read On My Marriage Prospects, 1888.
Okay. On My Marriage Prospects, 1888. In our nowhere town of hills and rocks and wood, there are hardly any black men, not my blood. But a woman's got to marry, so my mama says, off to the city of Virgins to meet that Mr. Balland, aged 41. I told my daddy, no, I will not wed a bag of bones. I do not care if he is blacker than obsidian. My own sister Lila, stuck with Wagoner degree, that sad face could make the sunshine cry. Or what of Hannah Lawrence and the youngest Obie boy? He's white as milk and snow. You would not catch me with a man whose people thought me low. There is someone. He's a porter at the Sanctuary Inn. His skin is brown and gold like autumn afternoons. In his uniform, he resurrects my soul. My daddy says he'll surely roll right out of town the way he rolled right in. Good Lord, I say, there's more to life than church and butter. I've read poetry. My daddy says he's seen the world. He says it's cold. Well, it's cold here too, and small as yesterday without love.
Thank you so much. I love that poem so much.
Thank you.
I love some of the lines, the language, the predicament she finds herself in, which of course would be the case in 1888 in Vermont. So I'm going to start with lines, my favorite lines. That sad face could make the sunshine cry. That just, I love that. And then I say there's more to life than church and butter. I've read poetry. And then small as yesterday. It's small as yesterday. That was wonderful. So you do tackle race in a few, more than a few, I think, of these poems. And mm-hmm. I wonder if you can just talk about that, and if you sort of had any rules for yourself as you were touching on these subjects.
Can you say what you mean by rules?
Well, I think there's a lot now about, you know, who's writing about whom, uh-huh. and whether or not we have the mm-hmm. right to write about another mm-hmm. Person's life right. and experience.
Yeah.
I thought you did it very well. I'm not saying that I question it. I'm wondering, though, as you set out to write this and some of the other poems, was there anything that you thought, okay, well, I'm going to do it this way or...
Right. Well, first of all, that question you raise, it's a good question. It's a nuanced question. It's an important question, and it's an open question. And, I mean, just as an aside... Orison, the publisher, wonderful publisher, ran this collection by a representation reader, sensitivity reader, just to double check, because they and I take that question seriously.
Yeah.
And I don't know the answer. I was faced with the question of whether to exclude or include.
Right.
That's what I faced. And I couldn't exclude history. It just seemed like that would be just repeating what I had been prompted to like overcome. So what I tried to do, and it wasn't hard because that's what I tried to do with all the poems, is to create very specific characters in very specific situations with very specific circumstances. So this is not a poem about young Black women. This is a poem about this particular young woman with this particular personality and in this particular family, you know, based on research. And my sincere hope is that it's respectful. So my rule was more, how could I not?
Right. And I think what you said about it being very specific about this specific character is one really important aspect of your approach. And I think the fact that the first thing I wanted to talk about was the language in this poem and some of the things that she said in her voice says that you succeeded there. The other thing I would say is that there's another poem that comes at race from a different perspective. It creates a balance. So let's get to the Tears and Fears Cafe. At the Tears and Fears Cafe after the Great War, 1919. And one thing I loved about this is just thinking about this little business going all the way through these years.
Okay. You want burnt bread with an iron crust, a carp's strafed head on a broken plate, dove's gut, angry meat bled dry. Whiskey that cuts across your tongue to the dead part. You want the scald, but they bring you quiet, dark plums. They bring sweet, cool cream. They know why you've come. They know what you've seen. They can read it on your wrists. They'll take you like this, empty.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. I love the nuance of this poem, the fact that there is such a narrative voice. And then you go back to the title and you say, oh, this is after the Great War. Oh, I see who's speaking. Just really beautiful. And from the first stanza to the second, there is this injection of relief and comfort that the cafe can offer. It's just really wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah. And the detail, again, we talked before about specificity. I mean, you really are presenting characters with very individualized voices and experiences. So, you know what? Let's next just talk quickly before we read another poem about titles. You know, I said that about realizing, oh, this is about the Great War. That poem was titled At the Tears and Fears Cafe After the Great War, 1919. You have another one. That's called The Forced Sterilization of the Abenaki People, 1931. We're not actually going to read that one. And then you have another one that's called Peonies, 1924. So I wonder how you choose to title your pieces. When do you feel like a title should tell more, like the one you just read? And when might you allow it to remain somewhat obscure and let the reader figure it out?
Mm-hmm. Well, in some cases, like in Peonies, which we're not going to read, I think the surprise is really important. And the poem itself gives the information that's necessary to put the event and the characters in context. But in some other cases, I leaned on the titles to give information, to provide that context so that for instance, the forced sterilization of the Abenaki people. The poem itself does not mention that, so I need the title to tell the reader that that's what we're talking about. And in some cases, you know, there are two poems, probably more, but I can think of two poems where you know right from the beginning that the speaker dies at the end. And that's okay, because the point is not the surprise. The point is, how does that come to pass? Mm-hmm. Those are some of the decisions that I made about titles and the years. You know, I mean, if I were reading this collection, because I'm always looking everything up, I would be like, what happened in 1924? What happened in 1931? And I would be Googling, but hopefully you could still, like, you know, get what you need from the book without having to, like, have your Google friend at your side.
Absolutely. Yeah. I did not have my Google friend at my side.
Good. Yay.
We're going to skip ahead a little bit. I wonder if you could read Susan Rowan, comes to Elsewhere Farm, 1966.
Okay. Never mind what I left behind. I love so many things here. The fogs lift, the way our white peacocks parade before the pigs. Marie's plaid shirt flapping as she urges the splattered cows back to the barn in evening. I love the neon parrots, the one-eyed emu, the shiny shards of mirror glittering in the atrium, the bantams strutting and clucking as if their eggs were gold, the speckled mornings of milking. Tonight, Marie swims Turtle Pond in moonlight, piercing its bright swath of quiet, pulling her square body through it, tacking tremulous light to the blackness underneath, while I stand among the peacocks and birds of paradise. I love how the old fear is a tiny pebble turned silver.
Thank you very much. One of the things I just love the most is how you heighten the sadness of the past only through presenting the happiness of the present. Mm. Almost without any mention, but the very beginning, never mind what I left behind, tells us there is a behind, there is a past, there's a backstory here, and that makes the present so much more special. I loved that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and the beautiful language and the fact that, again, in this poem, we figure out the context through the title. Susan Rowan is speaking, you know, not Tom Rowan, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So we have a little sense of what was left behind, you know, and what kind of bias perhaps she's faced in the past. And then that old mm-hmm. fear is a tiny pebble turned silver. I love it. The other thing that this poem made me think of that I wanted to talk about was transitions, because there's this wonderful list of the things that she loves. And then in the next stanza, tonight Marie swims. And so all of a sudden we're in story. And that's such a great transition. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that.
I think I made this transition just to become more specific and to present the character. Also, the first section is so positive and presents something that's so beautiful and perfect. And, you know, I can't do that. There has to be the dark side of everything. And I think the second part that brings up the blackness underneath the light, for me, suggests that, as you said, that fear is not gone. You know, that there are certain things that you can get away from that don't necessarily get away from you. And so I used that second section to make the speaker's relationship to her environment and to her partner a little bit more complex.
Great. I want to ask you a couple questions that aren't having you read at this very moment. I wonder if you can talk about what you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners who clearly are readers.
Oh, that's such a dangerous question because we could spend like the next 12 hours.
How about two titles?
Going on. Well, I just finished reading some prose called When We Cease to Understand the World by Chilean writer Benjamin Labutut, I think you say his name, which blew my mind. And really, even though it was prose, just I feel like I learned a lot about how to write and how to, and I feel like it gave me a lot of permission in terms of how to think about the world. And I am currently reading The Tradition by Jericho Brown, who I love. And I just have been, I can't say reading from beginning to end because it's a big book, but I just recently went back to my Echo Anthology of International Poetry, which is edited by Ilya Kaminsky and Susan Harris. And it was 2010, so it's not a new book. And I always benefit from getting out of the United States in terms of poetry. This is poetry from a lot from Eastern Europe, but from all over the world. And it's really a wonderful reset for me.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'll stop there.
Let's see. We are now into the now section, and we're not going to be able to read as many of them. But I wonder if you could read Midnight Till Four.
Okay. Tonight it's Kandahar, the dream of the little girl with two of his bullets in her. Sometimes it's the arm with a perfect hand attached. Sometimes Bill Caldwell's face silently blowing away. Tonight it's Kandahar. Dave Franklin walks up and down Main every night from midnight till four. At the Tears and Fears Cafe, the light in the kitchen is on. 4 a.m. Finally, Max unlocks the door. He takes a chair from the table. Ramona sets Dave's place, a cup, a plate, a teaspoon, a bowl with packets of sugar, cream in a miniature pitcher, a menu that's always the same. Every day except Monday, blueberry pie and hot coffee, Andre oiling the bread loaves, Max writing out the day's specials, Ramona folding the napkins, wild white wings, while the eyes of the street lights close slowly and dawn kills the shadows on Maine.
Thank you. So this is the poem, this is one of the poems that presents the Tears and Fears Cafe. And as I said before, your collection kind of shows how then and now, you know, history can repeat itself. And here we have, Kandahar instead of the Great War, and Dave and his haunting memories of the war. I thought you did a beautiful job of the personification of objects offering some suggestion into his mindset. And again, you have the kind of list of comfort, you know, that the cafe can offer. But then the napkins have wild white wings and the eyes of the streetlights close slowly and dawn kills the shadows. Beautiful. Do you have a cafe like that in town?
No, I've had that imaginary cafe in my mind for much longer than writing this book. We have a little nice cafe, but I sometimes you have to invent things for yourself, you know, like I have imaginary grandmothers that I have to sometimes, you know, get comfort from, and imaginary cafes. So sometimes reality is just like not doing it. So then there's nothing to do but invent the Tears and Fears Cafe.
Right. Although even though you're drawing on your own town as far as creating Sanctuary Vermont, it is a fictional place and you can draw on other towns. And, you know, yeah. There are cafes, or there were. I mean, a lot of them have unfortunately closed. I'm thinking of Calvi's in Middlebury. Wasn't that Calvi's, the ice cream shop and soda fountain and cafe?
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. I think they're not there anymore for a while now. Anyway, a cafe like this that can go through time and be such a grounding place for and meeting place for community. Anyway,
I thought that was wonderful. I guess I'd want to say about the cafe is that there's a lot in this book about how awful people can be toward each other, and how they have been toward each other in history in this state. And I was thinking that a lot of things that you see going on in this little rural town are not that different in terms of division as what's going on more broadly in this country and even the world. And it's easy to think that's all that there is. Mm-hmm. But for me, the Tears and Fears Cafe really embodies people's capacity to make a community and to show up for each other with compassion. So it's imaginary, but I don't think it's fantastical. You know, I think that this is a character too, you know, that really holds a place for that other capacity we have. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, great. So I'm going to do something I wasn't expecting to do, because we only really have time for one more little conversation. And I'm instead of assigning you a poem, I'm wondering, do you want to pick a poem that you'd like to read? And then can you offer some advice for writers who want to write, who just write writers of poetry? Okay. Whether or not it has to do with the poem you choose. And I'm sorry, I should have told you this ahead of time, but I'm doing it rather spontaneously.
That's okay. Well, I'll choose one that you chose that is maybe a little lighter than some of the others. The difference between a year and a lifetime. And I wrote this at the beginning of the pandemic, which, of course, at that time I thought would be over in a year. Okay. For a year, you can exult in a feather. For a year, you can forget what hit you. Forget the blade that cut through the turpentine of mango. For a year, you can plan the party you will throw when the year is over, or plan an assignation at the corner of thyme and jasmine. For a year, you can read the headlines, feed the sparrow, listen for wing beats just outside of earshot. Beat the ground for earthworms. Excavate the dreams you dreamed the year before. For a year, you can be lonely as pajamas in the daytime. Lonely as the doorknob. Lonely as the threshold. Lonely as the light shaft on the polished wooden floor. You can do it for a year. A year is just a door you are slowly walking through. But a lifetime is this window, its eye, that sky, this wind.
So good. I love that.
Thank you.
I love that. And it's a great one to finish with. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you do so well is a kind of list. And I wouldn't call this a list poem because there's a lot more going on. But when you want to give us a little bit of detail to kind of hold on to, you do beautiful lists.
Thank you.
Yeah, and one of my favorite parts of this is lonely. What is lonely? It's lonely as pajamas in the daytime, as the doorknob, as the threshold, as the light shaft on the polished wood floor. Beautiful. Also, I've never heard anyone say anything about that turpentine smell in mangoes when they've gone a little too soft, but you're right. That's exactly what it smells like.
Or the taste if you accidentally get the skin.
yeah, wonderful. And just beautiful. So let's see. Do you have any advice for poets or aspiring poets?
I can only give the advice I have for myself, because maybe advice for one person isn't great advice. And one is just the obvious that everyone says is that I have to show up for it. You know, and I am terrified of the blank page or screen. So it's not easy to sit there in front of my big blank screen, but you have to show up and write something. Also, for me, it's important to give myself the permission to write the poems I have to write, even if they're nothing like the poems that I love or the poems that are being published. You know, I have to get out of the poem's way, which is hard because you have to stop getting distracted by all that external stuff. And I guess the most important thing for me that I remember to sort of help me write is to always remind myself that, writing is an act of service.
Fantastic. Before we go, I want to just say that I've been speaking with Laura Budovsky-Wisniewski, whose new collection of poetry is Sanctuary Vermont, published by Orison Books. Laura, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really been wonderful to talk with you. I really appreciate it.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Laura Budovsky-Wisniewski. You can learn more about her work at laurabudovskywisniewski.com, and her last name is spelled Wisniewski. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Laura Budovsky-Vishnevsky, set a timer and start writing. Do not stop. Even if you have to occasionally write the same word over and over until the next word comes, keep it up. When the timer goes off at whatever point you designated, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 20, stop writing. If what you were creating was poetry, use the next little while to make line breaks in the piece. Then delete everything that's not interesting and see what you've come up with. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. It makes my day when people write to me and tell me what they're thinking. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com, where you can get all the archived episodes. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are also available wherever you get your podcasts. Just subscribe to have them sent to your podcast app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. You can also access the podcast and link to our social media presence at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and talk about it with people who might enjoy. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.